Warning, because of the extreme content in this podcast, it is not appropriate for children. It contains depictions of violence, language, and disturbing subject matter. It is recommended strictly for adult audiences. Parental guidance is suggested.
My name is Joey Siaglia, and I am so excited to welcome you back for Season 4 of Murder Phone. Have you ever had a conversation with a serial killer and lived to tell about it? My brother, Tony Siaglia, a traumatic brain injury survivor and subject of the best-selling book, The Serial Killer Whisperer, has spoken for hundreds of hours with some of the world's worst serial killers. This season is titled Finding Megan Emmerich. In July of 1973, 17-year-old Megan Emmerich disappeared from Seward, Alaska. Her body has never been found. Megan was believed to be one of Robert Hansen's victims. Robert Hansen is the worst serial killer in Alaskan history, and he shared a cell with Tony's friend Manfred West for over 7 years. During that time, Hansen shared many secrets with West, including the location of his hidden cabin where we believe Megan Emmerich has been buried for over 3 decades. Tony, along with our father and co-host Al Siaglia, we'll share hours of tape-recorded conversations with Manfred West that detail some of the most intimate stories that Hansen ever shared in that jail cell. This season, with the help of prisoner Manfred West, Tony will finish the quest he started over 15 years ago, finding Megan Emmerich. This is Murder Phone.
Hey, you murder phoniacs! This is Tony Siaglia, the Serial Killer Whisperer. We are really excited to have Bill Satterberg join us on Murder Phone today. He moved to the state of Alaska when he was 8 years old and has never left. Bill has practiced law in the state for over 40 years and has some of the most incredible stories you will ever hear. He has known Manfred longer than I do and was the first attorney to represent him just prior to the Volger case in 1993. Bill has graciously taken some time to be with us and share some stories about Manfred and the Volger case that have never been revealed. We also share a common bond and agree that after 50 years, Megan Emmerich needs to be found. Bill has agreed to help us any way he can and bring closure to the survivors of the Emmerich family. Welcome to Murder Phone, Bill.
How about we start with how did you happen to meet Manfred? And why or what was it for?
Well, I worked for a few years for the Attorney General's office up here. And then in 1980, I went worked for the U.S. government for a year and then came back and opened up my private shop about 1983 after a short stint with a larger law firm. And one of the areas that we used to work on was criminal defense work for the firm that I worked with before I opened my own store. And about the mid-90s was when this whole thing with Joe Volger came down, I think 1993 or thereabouts. And I'd been practicing private criminal defense work for about 10 years. And so my name was somewhat known in town. I had done some murder cases. I had done some other types of trials. We also did about half of my work was civil, which means non-criminal, but the other half was fairly significant criminal defense cases, like I said, including some murders. And Freddie, like anybody else, I got a call one day saying, I need a lawyer. And Fairbanks being a small town, we only have back then, I think we had about 25,000 people. We were the second largest city in the state of Alaska, by the way. We may still occupy that position, although it's up in the air.
25,000, right?
About 25,000. We're tripping over each other up here. You know, the whole state of Alaska, incidentally, only has about 750,000 people, half of which are indigenous, our Alaska Native population. But otherwise, Anchorage is a big city. Anchorage has about 250 to 300. Fairbanks is the second largest at about a tenth of that size. So that tells you about Alaska a little bit.
Yeah.
Freddie contacted me. He had been arrested at the time. He had been, and that's where I first got to meet him.
Okay. All right.
The basis of his arrest at the time, it was kind of an interesting story, a little backstory on it, is that he had been arrested for arson at the time. They didn't know, they knew about the murder of Joe Vogler, but they didn't have any proof of it. There was no corpus delicti or body that had been found. It's kind of a long story, but the first time I got involved, I remember driving home on a road called Farmers Loop Road. My wife and I live up on 20 acres outside of town, the old homestead for the McGrath Road homestead. And they had the road blocked off, the police cars on both ends and flashing red lights and everything. And I had to take a detour to get home. And that's the first, contact, if you will, that I had with Freddie at all, was when they were had his house surrounded and it was on fire. Which I'll get into here in just a minute, but that's how I first met him. But shortly after that, I got a call. He had been arrested for arson for the house burning down, and he needed a lawyer.
Okay. Let me tell you that we actually played an episode with Manfred describing what it was like being in there, what happened. it was quite a story. So, the listeners are going to be happy to hear this, and they know what you're talking about. So when you say arson.
It's interesting because I belong to this. In fact, I was one of the founding fathers or founding people, I guess we call them nowadays, of the Steves Volunteer Fire Department, also a medic unit called Interior Rescue. And I was the founder of both of those along with some other people. And our motto at Steves Fire was surround and drown. And we almost did drown Freddie. So we told you about that. They found him in the
ice water.
In the crawl space, suffering from hypothermia.
Yes.
I got this call from Fred. And Freddie said, can you come out and see me? So I went out to the jail and I met with him. And I should preface this discussion coming up with attorneys have a very strict rule of confidentiality. Extremely strict. And in fact, in this particular matter, it was exercised quite a bit by me because Joe Vogler, the person that Freddie had killed, was actually a person I knew. He was an acquaintance. I got along with him. He was a renegade, but occasionally he would come into my office and try to preach the Constitution at me. He claimed to be a constitutional scholar. I didn't agree with that, incidentally. I thought he was more of a big talker. But he would come in and sit in my office and tell me about, the Constitution says this and the Constitution says that. Joe himself had formed his own political party called the Alaska Independence Party. And prior to meeting Freddie, we had a Governor Wally Hickel, who had been governor of the state of Alaska years ago and then went to work for President Nixon as Secretary of Interior. Hickel later got fired by Nixon for being rather outspoken and returned to Alaska. And then in 1990, Wally was going to run for governor again, but the problem was the Republican slate had already been filled by someone else, and so he needed a party to run on. And the party that was chosen a lady up here, Arthur Sturgilewski, was running for governor. Governor Hickel, Wally Hickel, went to Joe Vogler and said, can I run on the Alaska Independence Party? We've had a couple of strange elections in Alaska over the years. Lisa Murkowski, who some of the followers might know, actually is our senior Alaska senator. She ran a write-in campaign several years ago and was successful. There's only two people ever in the U.S. have been successful in a write-in campaign, Strom Thurmond and Lisa Murkowski. I was very highly placed in Lisa's campaign. But prior to that, my first experience with any type of politics was on Governor Hickel's campaign. And that year, my wife and I had been separated at the time. And we've been together now, by the way, for 46 years. But at the time, we did have some time off. And rather than going out and, I guess, finding somebody else to party with, I got involved with a party and helped Hickel on his election. I was a person that was responsible for everything north of the Alaska Range for the governor, handling that at the time. And he had taken Joe Vogler's party and ran on that Alaska Independence Party, which does become important, which I'll explain later on.
Okay.
Joe Vogler used to come in. He would tell me that he didn't like America. He wanted to be buried in Canada, which he told lots of people. He wanted to be buried in Canada. His wife, by the way, was buried in Canada after she passed away. I always used to laugh. Joe would drive either Japanese or German cars, Mercedes, and I always criticize him about driving on American-built highways with American taxpayer dollars and wanting to have Alaska secede from the Union. That he wanted Alaska to secede. He wanted us to become our own nation. There were a lot of fiery discussions he had, videos where he was saying basically, you know, revolution, if you will, preaching revolution. He'd say things, let's shoot the sons of bitches and that and stuff, and was quite a fiery guy.
Yeah, sounds fun.
So what happened is that, obviously, Hickel got elected in 1990, and then in 1993, I think it was, Joe Volger was killed. And at the time, nobody knew where the hell Joe was. We didn't know if he had left Alaska. We didn't know if he had been killed or anything else. He just disappeared. Joe had always talked about two things. Number one, he said, well, if he ever killed anybody, he could bury him in a mining claim under a pile of tailings and nobody would ever find him. Animals couldn't even dig through it. Or he'd leave Alaska and move to Canada. So there was supposition whether Joe had moved to Canada or whether, you know, somebody had killed him and buried him. Well, about that time, it came, and I'm kind of giving the historical side, not as much as how I got involved, but street talk started going around among the criminal milieu, we call it, criminal element in Fairbanks, which, again, is a small town, that Freddie West, who is also known as Cartoon Fred, had killed Joe Volger. They couldn't prove it, but that's what they suspected.
That was the
rumor. That's when I got involved, was after the fire. And Freddie called me out to the jail to meet with him.
Okay.
I have to tell you, Freddie was an interesting character. I like Freddie, and I agree with the introduction that Freddie has spent more than enough time in prison, in my opinion. And I think when people learn the background of the story, they'll realize that in many respects, Freddie was victimized as far as what happened because of the fact that he killed a politically high-level person, Joe Volger, who had debt owed to Joe Volger by Governor Wally Hickel, who was the person that was involved in being governor that period of time that I'd been involved in his election on.
Right.
Okay, so what happened is Freddie calls me out there and he explains that he's in jail for arson and I said, why, and we're talking about it. And he does explain to me that, yes, I killed Joe Volger. Okay, well, of course, I'm intrigued at that point. We hadn't really discussed whether I would be his attorney or not if they ever got prosecuted, but I was providing legal advice. The jail system, by the way, in Fairbanks is secure. There were no cameras or anything else recording. And we meet in these little small rooms and spent quite a bit of time talking. The story Freddie told me was that Joe Volger had contacted him because Joe, who wanted Alaska to secede from the Union and was convinced that he was a fairly paranoid guy and was convinced there were conspiracies all over the place, wanted some plastic explosives, some C4 or Semtex, which is the Russian version, but he wanted some plastic explosive. Mm. Freddie had put the word out that he had plastic explosive that he could sell from Joe Volger, and he was hooked up with Joe. So he had apparently gone up there and sold Joe basically some modeling clay that had been, he had impregnated with some aromatics, so it smelled volatile. Joe had called Freddie and said, hey, I need some more of that really good plastic explosive. Can you bring me some, please? Now, what Freddie explained to me is he said, you know, I thought Joe probably knew, or maybe he knew this was fake plastic explosive, but maybe he didn't because he would have had to set some off to find out. And of course, maybe he hadn't done that. Although many gold miners in Alaska do have a fairly good cache of explosives just because they're mining gold.
Right.
Freddie said, I drove up to Joe's house. Joe's house is located on a hill overlooking Fairbanks, overlooking a golf course. And so he said, I drove up to Joe's house and I pulled in the yard. One thing about Joe, he was a fairly paranoid person. And as a result, in fact, I think he was 80 years old or so when he died. But Joe always used to have his house surrounded by a bunch of geese. Now, we found in Vietnam that geese were an excellent watchdog. I mean, you get into an area where there's geese, they will fire off immediately, very noisy, and sometimes they'll even attack you.
Really?
So geese are a great watchdog. And Joe had these geese always running around his yard. And he had this old log house located up on this subdivision that he had built. Well, Freddie comes in, Joe comes walking out. Joe always used to wear this blue kind of a field jacket, and he always used to carry a little 25 caliber gun in the pocket. And so Joe comes walking out. "You son of a bitch, you ripped me off. Damn you," and all this stuff. And he pulls out a gun and he takes a shot at Freddie. Boom, shoots a 25 caliber gun. The bullet goes into the door of the truck that Freddie was driving.
Okay.
And when the police investigated this case, they did find a bullet hole in the door and a bullet that had not penetrated the second level of the door panel. 25 caliber gun, you're better off throwing rocks at somebody if you want to kill them.
Right.
So Freddie, on the other hand,
went in the door.
Yeah. Yeah, went into the door there. And Freddie, on the other hand, had brought his own pistol. I think it was a 38 is what he told me. And so Joe then takes the gun, puts it to Freddie's face, and pulls the trigger again. I mean, he's going to kill Freddie.
Yeah.
The gun jams. Gun jams because part of it, and Freddie said that the gun had a bunch of goose feathers stuck in it or something like that. But what I don't know if that was true or not, whether it was lint from his jacket or goose feathers. But at that point, Joe turns around, and he's walking away from Freddie, and he's trying to clear the gun so he can get it to fire again. Freddie at that point takes his gun, takes a shot at Joe, boom, and misses. Freddie said the first shot missed. He said, "Bill, if you ever go up to that log cabin of Joe's, you're going to find a bullet buried in the logs." He said, "I hit the house. I didn't hit Joe." So then he shoots again, and he hits Joe right in the back of the head. Joe goes down like he's been poleaxed. He's dead. So Freddie at that point, of course, panics. He takes off, drives out of the subdivision, goes down the hill, and parks in front of the golf course down below. The golf course is probably, it had to be probably a quarter mile directly from Joe's house, and drive distance, it was probably closer to a mile, okay? So Freddie parks down below Joe's house near the golf course, and I may have my distances off there, of course. And he says he waits for sirens. He figures that state troopers or the ambulances or somebody are going to be coming. And he said he waits there for quite a period of time, and nobody shows up. Nobody shows up. He doesn't know who's there. And so he, I'll go back up and check on him again. So he drives back up, and he says, "I pull up there, and Joe's laying dead on the doornail in the parking lot of his house, his parking area. The geese are honking and quacking all over the place." And so he picks up Joe. He wraps him in a blue tarp, and he throws Joe in the back of his pickup truck. One of the great mysteries during Freddie's case was, and I asked Freddie this, what happened to the fedora? Joe had not only a blue field jacket he always used to wear, but he also wore a fedora, which he always kept kind of canted at an angle, a felt fedora hat. And Freddie, what happened to the fedora? When I spoke to Freddie earlier this week, I asked that question again. The first time he said, Bill, that's the big mystery. That's the mystery. I always sort of thought, what's all this bullshit? I mean, what happened to fedora? Well, this time he told me. He said, it was on the passenger seat of my car, my truck. It was on the passenger seat of my truck. I don't know where it went. I don't know if it fell out or if somebody stole it. But yes, I had the fedora, but he didn't know where it went. Okay, so I guess that was a mystery. He didn't know where the hell it went.
Right.
Well, at that point in time, Freddie was also using a lot of drugs and alcohol or whatever. Mainly drugs, as I recall.
Yeah.
So he could have forgotten where he put it. And so he takes off with Joe, and he drives out of Fairbanks up a road called Chena Hot Springs Road, which by its name leads to a place called Chena Hot Springs. It's a very big tourist resort and very well received. And at about 26 mile, he pulls in and he buries Joe's body on some property owned by a local real estate agent, a lady named Jerry Ostro. I don't know if Freddie knew Jerry or not, but that's where he chose to bury Joe's body.
Is this out in the middle of nowhere?
What's that, Tony?
Is this out in the middle of nowhere?
Pretty much. It's off the road in an old gravel pit. I used to go up there with these buddies, and we'd shoot our machine guns and stuff in this gravel pit. Well, you can have a machine gun in Alaska, by the way, if you have a license, and a bunch of us do. And so we'd shoot the machine gun probably right over there. We might have been standing on Joe. Who knows? But not that during that period of time.
Uh-huh.
Because once I learned that Joe had been buried up there, I did not go beyond 16-mile Chena Hot Springs Road after that. Because I probably would have wanted, out of curiosity, to pay homage to Joe, who used to sit in my office and talk to me, and just say, is the guy really buried up here? And about then, I'm sure the troopers would have shown up, and it would have been a very embarrassing situation.
Right.
And so I got arrested once in my own professional career, and, you know, it's not something you want to do often.
Right.
So anyway, and by the way, what I got arrested for was something that was very hilarious. That's another story in itself. When I was arguing that something was not a weapon in the courtroom, And the next thing I know, the judge said, well, that's a jury question, Mr. Satterberg. And the next thing I know, put your hands behind your back, and they hauled me off to jail.
And out of the courtroom?
It was a claim to be a pair of brass metal knuckles that they claimed I had bought. And I had bought something called a kubaton, which is a karate fighting device. But the judge ruled, well, they could be metal knuckles. And then the cop threw me in jail. But back to the original story. Freddie goes out there, and that's where Joe's buried. I explained to Freddie at the time, look, Freddie, they don't even know if Joe's dead, number one. If you don't talk about it, you got an arson charge being brought against you. But the fact of the matter is nobody can prove it was arson. And so just keep your mouth shut. Don't talk about this stuff. And if they do discover Joe's body at any point, you got a hell of a self-defense argument because the guy was shooting at you. And then instead of getting charged with first or second degree murder, you could probably bring it down to manslaughter, which is reckless homicide in Alaska, or even negligent homicide.
I always wondered why he opened his mouth. Yeah, right.
We get asked about that
all the time.
Yeah, we did talk about it a million times.
Yeah. Now we gotta rewind here a little bit. Now let's go back to the fire on Farmers Loop Road.
Okay.
What happened on that was that Freddie told me at the time. He said, "I said, well, Freddie, how did this fire get started? Because that's what he was charged with." He said that he had originally been in a rehab program at a local treatment facility here. And he told me this last week, by the way, that he got kicked out of the rehab facility. And he thinks that the investigator who was investigating the case, a gentleman named Jim McCann, who used to say McCann always gets his man, but that McCann had orchestrated Freddie getting kicked out of the rehab center. Because if Freddie got kicked out of the rehab center, he would be back out on the street. They would be able to follow him, maybe get an idea of what he was doing. Maybe he'd start drugging or drinking again, and he'd become more talkative. But what Freddie did when he got kicked out of the rehab center is he went out to this place on Farmers Loop Road. It was about 2.5 miles from my house. I live on McGrath Road, which intersects with Farmers Loop. And it was about 2 miles down Farmers Loop from the intersection with a highway we call the Stees Highway, which used to go up to where Joe's mining claims were. What happened is that Freddie's in this cabin he's staying at, but he's actually living in a old beat up military gray olive brown panel truck that was parked behind this place, probably 1940s or 50s panel truck. Rusted out, you know, but that's where Freddie was sleeping, was in the panel truck. And in fact, when I inspected one time, there's an old sleeping bag laid out there and a few other things we'll talk about. Freddie, because the street talk was, Freddie had been talking to people. One thing Freddie had a problem with, he talked a lot. And he had told people that, you know, he had killed Joe Vogler. And so the word was on the street. And of course, there's snitches up here. You know, they say snitches get stitches. But the point is, McCann had an idea that Freddie had been the one that killed Joe Vogler. So they had Freddie under surveillance. On the day of the fire, Freddie says, I'm sitting there and I see a motorhome come up and pulls up the street from the cabin, probably, 50 yards or something like that, maybe a little farther. And this guy gets out and he's swearing and cussing and kicking the tire and carrying on and putting on a big show about all upset. And then he starts walking down Farmers Loop Road towards the service station, which is about 2 miles away. Freddie says, I'm watching that motorhome because it just looked pretty suspicious, pretty contrived. It was kind of an act. He says, I see a curtain kind of pulling back and going closed and pulling back. And I realize that I'm under surveillance. Somebody's watching me from there. So he decides to call their bluff. So, I mean, Freddie takes and I found this out last week. At the time, I thought they were real guns. He said, no, Bill, they weren't. He had a BB gun, probably a Red Ryder BB gun, and he had a BB pistol that he had taped to his hand. And he had these taped to his hands, and he comes out the front door with these two BB guns taped to his hands. Going to have a showdown with the police. They're going to have a shootout.
Not smart.
Well, about then, the state troopers bail out of the motorhome. Okay, they come bailing out of the motorhome. Freddie has a change of heart. He changes his mind. Maybe I don't want to have a shootout. They got real guns. I got BB guns. So Freddie turns around and goes back in the cabin, closes the door. So now they got this standoff going because, as far as they know, Freddie is armed and dangerous. You know, he had the guns taped to his hands. He was going to go down shooting, you know, like the Alamo or something. McCann's on the phone. He's talking to Freddie and he's interviewing Freddie about, you know, what did you do? Did you really kill Joe Volga, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Freddie's talking to him. And one of the other legal defenses I saw at the time was a Fifth Amendment argument, because he was not free to leave. He may not have had handcuffs on, but he clearly was not free to leave. And under the Fifth Amendment, if you are not free to leave and you're being custodially interrogated, which is what McCann was doing, you have to give somebody their Miranda warnings. Oh. And so I saw that as an offense. All of Freddie's statements could have been suppressed. Okay, so that goes on for I don't know how long. And then what happens is that Freddie decides that he's got to get rid of some contraband and stuff, which is in the cabin. Now, this whole showdown took place, I believe it was in May. It was so that, you know, the snow was off the ground. It's not like that up here right now today. Today is April 29th, and we've got quite a bit of snow still up here. It's been a record year for snowfall. But back then, I just finished a 40-mile snow machine trip the last couple of days. Went out to a cabin, spent the night, and came back in. That's why I'm wearing my Zelensky shirt.
Zelensky shirt.
Yes! That's hysterical. That was great. That was good. That was funny.
Okay, so anyway, Freddie's sitting there, and he decides he's going to get rid of the he's going to get rid of the contraband. So there's a barrel stove in this cabin, which is something a lot of cabins have, a barrel stove. They get pretty hot. He lights a fire, and he throws probably marijuana or other stuff in the barrel stove to get rid of it, because he figures eventually they're going to raid the place, and he doesn't want them finding this stuff.
Right.
Now, the way the stove was built, I understand, is the stove stack went up, and then it made a 90-degree angle, and it went across the ceiling, which was a plywood ceiling on the roof, if you will, and then it made another 90 and went up through the roof. It was being hung by baling wire from the ceiling for maybe one or two lengths of stove. Well, the stove gets a real good fire going, and what often happens, what happened here, is a chimney fire started. And when the chimney fire starts, if you've ever heard one, they're scary. You go boom, 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 and what happened is eventually the stovepipe broke loose from the ceiling with a vibration. The wires gave way, and the next thing you know, the fire, now it's the smoke and the stuff's coming into the house. Freddie can't put the fire out at that point. The house catches fire. It's an old log cabin. It catches fire. My old alma mater, Steve's Volunteer Fire Department, responds. Freddie, meanwhile, decides to crawl into the crawl space. Survival percentage. I mean, it's pretty hard to shoot yourself with a BB gun anyway. But the point is, he jumps into the crawl space. And it's interesting because, you know, they show up. And when the fire's over, they're mopping up, and Steve's Volunteer Fire Department, like I say, surround and drown. We used to keep our water underground and up to the fire station, which was about 34-degree water. It was because in Alaska, we have things called permafrost, which are ice lenses in the ground, and that water was downright cold. It was as cold as the water you would get in an ocean, okay? I mean, an ocean with icebergs. We're talking cold water.
Uh-huh.
And when they're doing the mop-up, they find Freddie in the crawl space. Now, Freddie had been trying to kill himself. He had taken a piece of glass, beer glass or something, and he'd been trying to slit his wrists. Now, academically, if anybody needs to know, that's not how you slit your wrist by going across the tendons. You got to go laterally, folks. If you need some advice here, don't hold me to it. But the point is, he had cut marks across his wrist where he'd been trying to cut his wrist. And I don't know whether the cuts had been cauterized because of the hot glass or what, but he had these scars across his wrist, which had barely penetrated the surface. Okay. So when I met him in the jail, he had the marks on his wrist. You could see him. In fact, the first time I think I met him, they might have even been bandaged. I'm not sure. And so eventually they haul Freddie off to jail. So that's how I came to meet Freddie. And Freddie shared with me that here's where Joe Volger's buried, as I told you before. And my advice to Freddie at the time, having done quite a few criminal defense cases, just keep your mouth shut. They're probably going to have a hell of a time proving arson. Arson is intentionally burning down a place. And the reality is that isn't what happened. It was clearly an accident. It was a chimney fire that got away from Freddie. And the question would have been, why would you want to burn the place down? I mean, if you're going to commit suicide, use your BB gun. Okay. So,
suicide
anyway,
by cop, right?
What's that?
Could have done suicide by cop.
Yeah, well, originally he was planning on suicide by cop. Then it was going to be suicide by BB gun, I guess. Then it was going to be suicide by fire, suicide by broken beer bottle, suicide by drowning. Right. But Freddie never carried through on any of these things.
Okay.
Freddy really wasn't a dangerous guy. He was basically a thief. He was a drug user, and he stole stuff. And he didn't have a history of being a violent person. Did he have evidence or history of being a bullshitter? Yeah, he was known for that. And he was known for being a thief. Pretty good artist, by the way. I've got quite a few of his drawings and paintings hanging here in the office.
He painted a lot for Tony.
Yeah. In fact, he just sent me some paintings here last week or so. And this cabin I was out with these people last night, the guys talking, hey, I got a big painting that Freddie West did of a pickup truck. And I said, geez, you might want to hang on to it. It could be a collector's item. He said, well, nothing else. It'll be a conversations piece in the cabin. He said, I'm going to bring it out to the cabin. We'll hang it up out here. We can talk about it when we're spending our nights out here. Because basically, the cabin, all we do is sit around and solve the world's problems, usually over a bottle of scotch.
Well, there's a lot of problems to solve, Bill. So I hope
there are. We found a whole bunch last night, too. I hope I don't look too bad for that.
No, you look great.
Uh-huh. Okay, there we go. Okay, so Freddie comes to me later, and he said, one day he calls me up and says, hey, Bill, can I meet with you? Sure, Freddie. So I go back out to the jail. And he says, well, he says, I want to tell you they're going to find Joe's body here tomorrow or so. I said, well, what do you mean? What are they going to find Joe's body? And he tells me a little bit more about his history. Turns out, Freddie says, I grew up in a dysfunctional family situation. I have a child. I had never been a father to that child. I think at the time he said his son was like 14 years old. He said, I've never been seeing the kid. I've never been a father to him. And he said, I've decided that I need to do something good for the kid. I have been institutionalized virtually all of my teenage and adult life. He said, I am used to living in institutions, whether they're juvenile facilities or prisons, and I don't really get along well on the outside. This is my home. Okay, Freddie, I can understand that. And so what it is here is that I have cut a deal that there's my cellmate is a prisoner here. And my cellmate, he said, was recently convicted. And actually, we all knew about this. The cellmate had been convicted on some federal drug charges, was actually awaiting transport to a federal penitentiary. He was a fairly big-time drug dealer in Fairbanks at the time. But he was Freddie's cellmate. The agreement they had was that the cellmate would pay Freddie on the outside, because that's how these deals go down in prison, is money changes hands between people on the outside. And then through code words or whatever, it's confirmed that the transactions occurred. And then whatever somebody's buying, whether it's alcohol, drugs, or whatever, the transaction takes place in the prison. In this case, Freddie had reached an agreement with this guy to give up Joe Volger's body and location in exchange for $100,000 to be paid to Freddie's kid. And so that was what the deal was. It would be $100,000 to be paid to Freddie's kid, to be afraid to pay to Freddie's kid on the outside. Very few people know this story, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, we knew a lot of stories, but never heard that one.
And Freddie confirmed it for me when I spoke to him again earlier, I think it was yesterday or the day before we spoke. What was interesting was the amount of money that was exchanged was, pardon me, I got an itch on my mustache here for a second. The amount of money which was exchanged was only $60,000, and it did get transferred on the outside. By the way, the drug dealer had his own attorney in this town. And I'm not going to use names on these two, even though the his drug dealer's attorney is still alive, but very much retired from the practice of law. He was older than I. I'm 72 years old, and this drug dealer's attorney, I think, is over 80 now. So what happened is that the money changed hands. Freddie was confirmed that the $60,000 changed hands with a promise to pay the other $40,000 at some future date. And so what happened is that they cooked up a story where the drug dealer got in touch with Jim McCann and said, hey, I know how to find Joe Volger's body. But to do this, I want my freedom from prison. I want these federal drug charges dropped completely and my conviction set aside. This is where Governor Hickel came into the equation. Governor Hickel was still governor at the time. He was a pretty strong Republican. We still had a Republican administration going at that point. And so what happened is that they cut a deal, and Hickel went to the feds and said, look, you know, if we find Joe Volger's body, who was the head of the Alaska Independence Party, and if this informant's information provides it, he gets out of jail. He gets out of jail. He gets a pass. Sure enough, the next day. And what the story was is that they had concocted a story where Freddie was talking in his sleep and he'd draw little pictures and codes and this and that. They came up with pretty much a bullshit story. Okay. But what happened is that the information was released to the state troopers, Jim McCann. And sure enough, they went out there the next day and they dug up Joe Vogler's body. Jim McCann solved Joe Vogler's missing crime. Joe Vogler has been found, big state headlines. And the same day, the one piece of headline that didn't come out is that the drug dealer got released from prison, record clean. Okay?
That fast.
That's what happened there.
Wow.
Now, I got to take you on a little side trail again, since this is Alaska.
Yeah.
The drug dealer was a fairly big drug dealer in this state. Certainly in Fairbanks, our second largest city, as I pointed out. And what had happened is the way he got busted was that he had, they knew he was a dealer, but they had served a search warrant on his house. In fact, a good friend of mine at the time was one of the narcotics cops, and they had gone out there to serve the search warrant on the house. They didn't have any drug sniffing dogs at the time. The troopers couldn't afford those things. So as a result of that, they had gone out there. By the way, the drug sniffing dogs, another quick side story, they were pretty good until the dogs had been trained to locate marijuana, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine. But all they would do is alert to drugs. And of course, once marijuana got legalized in Alaska, they had to get rid of all those dogs because they couldn't differentiate. Anyway, the dogs went out there and or retrained them, but I think they just got a whole new batch.
Right.
But anyway, they didn't have dogs back then. So they're tearing the house apart trying to find the drugs and they can't find it. So the cop, Dave, goes in and he's in the bathroom. They're getting ready to leave. They're already packing up their kits. They haven't found anything in this guy's house. And he says, I'm sitting on the toilet, Bill, and I'm taking a crap. And I reach over, grab some toilet paper. I rip it off the wall. And the toilet paper holder falls out of the wall. And he says, I look behind it. It's pock full of all sorts of cocaine and stuff. The guy had been keeping his drugs behind the toilet paper holder in the bathroom.
Oh,
it's the one spot nobody thought of looking. Didn't have a dog alert on it. And if Dave had not had to take a poop, they would have never busted Mike. And they probably would have never found Joe Vogler's body. Wow. Okay, Mike is the first name of the drug dealer. That's all it tells you.
Unbelievable, man. That's unbelievable.
So that's Mike was the first name of the drug dealer. Like I said, that's as far as I'll get you guys. And Mike's no longer with us, so we don't really have to worry about that. Okay, so what happened there was that Freddie, when they did find Joe's body, I went to see Freddie. Jail. I said, well, Freddie, you're right. They found Joe's body yesterday or so. He goes, yeah. I said, well, I'm sorry. I'm not going to represent you. You're going to have to get yourself a public pretender. I'm a private attorney. I get paid by the hour for my time. And this has been fun meetings. And he had never paid me anything, by the way. He says, geez, Bill. He says, I really owe you. He says, I really owe you. Yeah, Freddie, I know why. He said, but I can't pay you. I said, that's okay, Freddie. We've known each other for a while. It's been fun visits. I said, he said, what are you doing tonight? I said, I'm going to take my wife out. We're going to go blueberry picking. He goes, blueberry picking? I said, yeah, we're going blueberry picking tonight. He says, you know, I know where the greatest blueberry patch in the world is. You're kidding me. I'll tell you what, Freddie, if you know where the greatest blueberry patch in the world is, and if you give it to me, and if it turns out to be the greatest blueberry patch in the world, your bills are paid. Well, Freddie was, as you know, a thief, and a lot of people called him a liar, but he didn't lie about that. Turns out that greatest blueberry patch in the world was directly behind the burned out cabin, right off Farmers Loop Road, less than 2 miles from my house. My wife used to go down there and pick blueberries till her heart's galore until an equipment yard moved in and bulldozed the whole backyard, which really pissed her off.
I bet.
Oh, yeah. You'd never mess around with a woman's blueberry patches in Alaska. That's, what was it? Congreve's, William Congreve's once said, hell hath no greater fury than a woman scorned.
Yes.
And anyway, when they bulldozed my wife's blueberry patch, that was a rough one.
I can imagine.
The only other thing to come out of that.
It was the best.
What's that?
He wasn't lying. It was the best.
Oh, no, he was spot on. Okay. And what was nice about it is we used to have to drive my wife up the road, 10, 20 miles to pick blueberries. We did find some grizzly bears hanging around that blueberry patch one time.
Oh,
not
really?
When she was there, but they were hanging around the area. It was a good blueberry patch. Even the bears knew about it. By the way, in Alaska, you don't, if you ever come up across a bear, you don't have to outrun the bear. You only have to be able to outrun your best friend.
I love that. That's great.
Yes.
And, the other one we tell up here is a person went into a sporting goods store one day and said, I need to buy a gun. And they said, what do you want? 22. What for? Bear protection. A sporting good guy said, there's no way in hell that a 22 is going to keep you from a bear. Why do you plan to save yourself from a bear? So shoot my best friend in the knee. Okay. Okay. Well, back to the story, folks. I'm just about till the end of it. The other thing that was kind of funny is Freddie came back and he said, Bill, can you do me a favor? He said, I used to sleep in that panel truck. And he said, there's 2 5-gallon pails of ammonium nitrate fuel oil. That is an explosive. Ammonium nitrate is a well-known fertilizer used in farms all over the country. But when you mix it with fuel oil, it becomes something known as ANFO, ammonium nitrate fuel oil. That's the same product that blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City years ago. Right. It was ammonium nitrate truck packed, Ryder truck packed with ammonium nitrate fuel oil. Well, Freddie's panel truck wasn't packed with. He only had 2 5-gallon buckets of it. But what I did, he's like, can you get rid of that? What was that?
That's still a lot, right, Bill?
I
mean, that's still a lot. I mean,
that's a lot. Yeah, well, it can do a number. You have to set it off with what they call a baloney stick or a booster. It was a dynamite cap won't set off. You actually need something stronger than that. Yeah. What I did for public service is I went and I got those 2 5-gallon pails, and I live up on a 20-acre old homestead where we have a hay field out back. And I'll tell you, the hay was in the best condition you've ever seen for about 2 years.
To use and, fertilizer, right?
I fertilized the backfield. I did the public a favor. I got rid of a bunch of explosives. Diesel itself is also known to be a fertilizer. All my wife knew is that if she had known about that, she probably would have wanted me to put them on the blueberry patch, but I didn't. Now, that was the end of my story with Freddie. He decided to go to trial. He had the public defender. I thought he had great defenses. He had the defense being, of course, self-defense. He had the Miranda warning. But instead, Freddie, actually, he didn't go to trial. He pled out. He pled to second-degree murder. And he was sentenced, I forget, some ungodly amount of time, 35 or 50, how many years?
85 years.
85 years?
Yeah.
Absolutely ridiculous. What it was a payback, in the political angle, if you will. Joe Volger had been killed by Freddie West, a ne'er-do-well, Fairbanks druggie, thief, you name it. And this was the basically the way of paying it back. Now, there's one other story that's kind of interesting. Is years later, I got contacted by a television show called City Confidential. And back then, Freddie waived the confidentiality rights, just like he has for this podcast. And Freddie said, Bill, go on City Confidential and talk to him about what happened. That show took the position that Joe Volger, who had been leading the secession movement in Alaska with the Alaska Independence Party, had been killed by the United States government because he wanted Alaska to secede from the Union and to join the United Nations. And so they had a bunch of people here in Fairbanks, and they would interview them. In fact, I think if you look at some of the old history of Joe Volger, you'll hear some local people that said, yeah, the United Nations, you know, Joe wanted to secede, and we think it was the United States government that had Joe killed. I got the interview on that. They had a camera with, you know, showing my face kind of shadowed up a little bit. And just look at the camera or look at the interviewer. Don't look at the camera and tell us a story, Bill. I'm thinking, God, here's my 15 minutes of fame. Now, maybe I'll get it on the podcast. Maybe I won't get it on this podcast. But I didn't get on that one. The only thing that happened in City Confidential was my name was in the credits at the end. And thanks to about 50 different names, including probably a couple of hamburger spots in Fairbanks. And it turns out that I called the producer. I said, hey, man, I told you the story about Freddie West. I told you what really happened. What happened here? And he goes, you know, Bill, I have to tell you, I believe you told us the truth. I believe that is the true story about how Joe Volger died. But it wasn't going to sell copy. It wasn't going to sell. So if anybody gets on YouTube and looks up City Confidential, the killing of Joe Volger, it may be on there. I don't know if it's on YouTube or not. But if you want to see me, you got to look in the credits. Okay?
You didn't make the cut.
No, I didn't have the good looks either. So I didn't make any. There wasn't anything played about me at all. You know, I kind of look like a shorter version of Danny DeVito.
Typical political bullshit.
Typical political crap. Typical Hollywood bullshit.
Yeah, it was up there. We've had a lot of reality TV. No, Alaska's had lots and lots of reality TV shows up here, as we know. Yeah. And whether it's the Deadliest Catch or Alaska's Troopers or Ice Road Truckers or Yukon, I mean, this town tends to thrive on, or the state tends to thrive on reality TV, which I personally like because it puts us in the spotlight. More right. tourists, we need those. I will say one thing. I was never impressed. Jim McCann, by the way, left the Alaska State Troopers. He ended up becoming a car salesman. And then I think he quit that job. And he ended up, now he does photography. He's got his photographs. But they always used to have this, McCann always gets his man. That was a state trooper that claimed credit for solving the Joe Vogel murder. He didn't solve it at all. It was given to him on a silver platter.
Yeah.
Freddie did come back to me, and he wanted to sue his cellmate for not giving him the other $40,000. I explained to Freddie I wasn't going to take the case, even though he offered it to me on a contingency, because in Alaska, in fact, in the legal system generally, there are certain types of lawsuits that are just void against public policy. And when I took a look at this thing, I thought, I'm going to have a hell of a hard time convincing a jury that we gave up a murder victim and that my client's entitled to be paid $40,000 for it.
Yeah, that's kind of a tough sell, right?
It was. Now, subsequently, Freddie did contact me with respect to the Emmerich case and indicated to me that he was sharing a cell with Robert Hansen down in Seward, and that to the same degree that Freddie had given up the location of Joe Vogler, he was hoping to get from Robert Hansen the location of some of his victims. And so I've been talking quite a bit for you guys. You want me to keep going, or do you have any questions so far?
I have one question.
Yeah. Sure.
Joe Vogler, were you a fan of his, like getting out of the nation? Or
I found Joe to be amusing.
Uh-huh.
I personally did not think Alaska should secede. I have always believed that Alaska should have almost nation status, but still be a state. But we are in a very strategic location militarily. We have every known mineral and economic quantity with the exception of bauxite, which is what we use for aluminum. We have timber resources, oil resources, fisheries, tourism, mining. I mean, Alaska's a great state. It's a phenomenal state. It's, you know, one-fifth the size of the United States. It has more coastline than the entire United States put together, which, by the way, is one of the problems you folks have now trying to find the body of the people that Robert Hansen killed, because we got a lot of coastline.
Yeah.
But Alaska's a great state. One reason I ended up studying some international law when I went through law school was I always felt that Alaska would occupy an extremely unique position in world politics. And we do. We do very much. But no, I was not in favor of secession at all. I thought Joe, my personal opinion was Joe was an idiot. He had a cult that followed him and kind of sang his praises. Uh-huh. Oh, Joe Vogler this and Joe Vogler that. In fact,
because we're kind of city slickers and stuff, we wanted to add, well, we are city slickers, you know. The question is, do you think this cabin that Hansen built would have withstanded the weather and everything? I think he built it in 70, 71, according to the wife. Do you think it would withstand it? Do you think it's still out there? I mean,
I would tell you that the odds are better than 50% it's still out there. There's cabins that I grew up in part on a homestead outside of Anchorage. My parents had a homestead, and I'd spend my summers up there. And there's a cabin on there when my folks bought that place. We didn't homestead, we bought it in 1965. That cabin is still there, and it's still standing. They do get old, but if Hansen built the cabin the way one would have expected of, he would have put it back in the trees, away from view, also to shelter it from the wind, because that particular area can be rather windy, shelter it from the wind, and if he put a good roof on it, it would withstand the snow load, although that particular area where we understand the cabin would be known for some pretty heavy snows. But if this cabin had a good roof on it, it should still be there. And even if it collapsed, it would just be the roof that collapsed. So I would say that, and of course, we got to know what he built it out of. Did he build it out of logs, or did he build a stick frame? But either way, I think it would probably, you stand a pretty good chance it's still there.
Okay. The way the story goes is that there was a barge that went ashore on one of the islands that's close to that area, and that Hansen told Manfred that he used that wood to build the cabin, the wood that he got from this island off this barge that hit, I guess it ran ashore there. And that's what he told Manfred.
And well, the island you're probably referencing is an island called Montague Island. It's a very large island. It's well known for deer hunting. Okay, and it's one of the largest islands in Prince William Sound. If you got the wood off of a barge, it probably would have been, you know, 2x4s, 2x6s, that type of stuff.
Okay.
Which may mean it's a little less durable. Log cabins up here last, they seem like forever. We'll come across them when we're snow machining in the woods, and you'll go walk in, there's old mining newspapers and stuff from way in the old days.
Wow. It is. It really is. And Manfred also said that he was pretty anal. He probably built it really well because that's the way he was. In fact, this last episode we just did, Bill, it was he was talking about the cabin that he was staying in. And he was describing it as if he brought girls and stuff there, that they would probably think it was a psychopath living there. This is Manfred, right? This was back when he was drinking, and he would bring girls out there and tell them he was going to cook dinner for them, and he'd give them a can of beans. And, you know, so it was kind of a funny story he was telling. And then either Tony or I asked him, hey, do you think that's probably what Hansen's cabin would look like? And he said, oh, no, no, no. He said Hansen's cabin would be neat. It would be really orderly. The guns that I told you about would still be there, the toothpaste and the toothbrushes for the kids. He said that's just the way he was. He said it would not be in disarray or chaotic. It would be like all together, which kind of runs along the lines of a serial killer. Yeah, that's the way they are for the most part. You know, they're very anal when it comes to doing things. So
writing letters.
It probably would be standing still. Given the kind of person he was that we heard.
You know, I've been told that Alaska has more serial killers per capita than any other state in the country. And it wouldn't surprise me if that's the case, because we have a lot of people that come up here kind of, you know, loners, get off the beaten path, especially up in the Fairbanks area, even more so than Anchorage right now. Anchorage has gotten, I hate to say it, but Anchorage has gotten pretty woke. Fairbanks, on the other hand, you still got a bunch of rednecks. You know, the standard vehicle up here is a pickup truck. We're down in Anchorage, they're now driving
Teslas,
Priuses or something like that.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah,
in fact, we call it Lost Anchorage.
Lost Anchorage. Yeah. I just can't. Woke and Alaska just don't go together in my mind, you know?
Not in my town. Now, in Anchorage, believe it or not, they may, but really? Fairbanks, no, we're, you know, interestingly enough, Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska, especially where I live, has the second most heavily armed city in the United States. There's the one that beats us right now, according to USA Today, which is located, I guess, in Wyoming.
Oh, really?
But the big difference is we don't report our guns, so we might be in front, you know?
Okay. Yeah, I got you. You never met Hansen, right? You didn't know.
No, I read the book years ago. In fact, I still have a copy of it. I didn't watch the movie. Once they indicated that they wanted Nicolas Cage instead of myself, I decided that's it. I'm not going to watch the movie.
I tried out for the part. I didn't get it either. So
yeah, Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, well, it was. We watched it.
Yeah,
it was pretty well done. I mean, it was all right. It wasn't bad. But it's interesting you read the book, because Manfred, when he got the book, because when he went to Arizona, they don't allow him in Alaska to have books on crimes by prisoners that are in that prison.
So we call those educational material.
Educational. Yeah, love it. So when he went to Arizona, in fact, we visited him in Arizona when he was over in Eloy, and he got that book. And then he went. He quoted on page 197, he told us that there's the inspector is asking Hansen questions, and he asked him about a cabin. And Hansen denied it. And Manfred was, he was outraged. He said, I don't know why they keep believing this guy. He said, because the inspector decided that Hansen was telling the truth and he was just using a fictitious cabin to make the girls feel at ease that he, I am taking you out to a cabin, when in actuality he was taking them out to kill them. But our feeling was this girl's bound. She's been tortured. She's bound and gagged and being thrown into an airplane or a boat. Are they really going to feel fucking relieved that they're going to a cabin? It just didn't make any sense. So, I mean, all the things that he said to Manfred lead us to believe 100% that there is a cabin. And the fact that
his wife
is paying, yeah, well, his wife for sure. I was going to use that last, but mm-hmm. that Manfred, you know, sketched a cabin. We have the sketch. Hansen sketched the cabin, crumpled it up, threw it in the garbage. Manfred picked it out of the garbage and mailed it to Tony. We still have that. Then he had Manfred, he described the cabin, and he had Manfred paint it. I don't know if you know this.
No, he I didn't.
Painted the cabin. And I believe Manfred painted another copy, which Hansen didn't know about, that he had given to a state trooper, he said. So that is floating around. We also have a copy of a painting of the cabin. So I'm pretty sure, I would, well, we're going to bet money that there's a cabin out there. Now, trying to find it's a different story. It's going to be tough, but I think we can do it.
Well, you know, Al, I think I mentioned to you that about a month ago, I spent the day with a governor who, Governor Dunleavy, who was actually my hunting partner.
But that's I spent what the you day. Were saying. That's a yeah, good yeah. yeah.
And so I had to go down to Juneau, though, and work on some stuff. And I met with him and we talked about this because you and I had just started discussing to a certain degree the stuff that Tony had been doing. Right. And so I asked the governor at the time, told him the story about Hansen, which of course he knew. And I said, you know, it may be possible that we've got some way of locating that. And I had with me, and himself was also the number two deputy attorney general of the state at the time, a gal named Carrie Mills. And the governor, they're not going to go on a fishing expedition, but if they had a good solid lead, they might try to track that down. And I do think it could be possible potentially to get a field trip for Freddie to go to, you know, to go to a Google Earth and take a look and take a look at the area where he thinks it might be. And that's something that probably could be arranged at some point, because the governor did indicate that he was very sympathetic. He said people need closure. And he said these families, you know, they still don't know where their daughters are buried. And so he wasn't adverse to it. But of course, it's not something the state of Alaska is going to spend any money on. Just go out there and fly helicopters along the coastline on the chance they might find a cabin.
Right.
But
right.
But if Freddie can narrow it down and say, okay, this is about the location we're talking, you never know that something like that might be able to be done.
Well, Fred said twice now, and it's on the podcast, but he in conversation with us, he said that given the proper tools, he could get somebody within 10 miles of where the cabin is. Without a doubt, he said he could do that. Now, I have gone through all the clues that he's given us. He you know, we gave all that back to the Foundation for Missing and Exploited Children, and that was way back in 2000. Well, you started in 2009 with the Seward Police. Then it went, they gave it to the Missing and Exploited Children people, and partner, they visited Tony three times and got a ton of information that Manfred had supplied. So in going through those, I would have to say that, you know, I don't know Alaska, Manfred does, that by the clues that he shared with us or with Tony, definitely that area could be narrowed down to a workable area to find the cabin. And we could subsidize. I was telling you this before. Do you think that the state would help us if we help subsidize the finances, the financial cost?
Any cabin like this in my opinion, as a hunter myself, we set our camps back in the trees a little bit to avoid unwanted visitors like fish and game enforcement. But the thing is that presumably you're looking at something that's probably within maybe 50 to 100 feet, maybe 150 yards, whatever, of the beach. And of course, my understanding is that Hansen flew a Super Cub, which is a pretty good performing aircraft, but you're going to be landing on the beach, obviously, unless he had floats. I don't think he had floats. I think he's flying out of Merrill Field, which would be a wheel strip. So that can even narrow it down some more, saying, is this a landable area where a person can get in and out of with a Cub? And so that could even limit it more for you. And then, of course, most people would probably park the aircraft, especially for somebody like Hansen, in a sheltered type thing, not only from wind and stuff like that, but also from prying eyes. Practically speaking, I think that could potentially be located. Back in the old days, I don't know how many years ago this has taken place with Hansen. You folks would know that, but maybe it could very well be that there might even be some surveillance video from that period of time, you know.
It was. Well, here's the thing. When he built the cabin, Bill, it was in 1970, 71, and he didn't have the plane then. He used a boat.
And so he came out of what, Seward?
And he came out of Seward. And he had about a 32-foot boat.
Straight shot.
And he went to this area. And the way he described it to Manfred was that he had his wife and he had his two little kids with him. And when they got out to this area, that's when he had found this barge. And he decided to get this wood. So when he was looking for areas, I think that the way the story went is he killed the seal. And when he went to get the seal carcass, it had floated back behind this inlet. And that's where he saw the opening. And he got his boat back there. And it was a perfect spot. And he built his cabin there. So this was in 71. Megan Emmerich, he took out of Seward in 1973. She went missing. So he still just had the boat. 1975, he took Mary Thill. And
now, where's his wife? Is she still with us?
She, I think, is still with us. His sister, I know, is still alive. And there is, in his photo album, because Manfred saw this, when he was in the cell with Hansen, there's a real funny looking rock that protrudes out of the water at the opening of this little inlet. I guess there's a lot of little inlets, right? Okay. But he said with that rock, it would really make it easy. He saw the picture of it, but if we had that picture, if say the sister would give it up, it would make it a lot easier.
Seem to me one of your resources would be to try to contact the ex-spouse and see what her recollection is. She might say, yeah, I remember where we used to go. We went out and turned left. We went out and turned right. I mean, even that alone, it can be helpful.
That that definitely could be. Missing and exploited children did visit her. And then they came back to us and said, yes, they showed her the sketch. Yes, she confirmed that they were out there, that they built a cabin, but she said, I could never find it on my own. She said, I was only out there a couple of times with the children, and that was it. But she definitely confirmed that they built a cabin out there.
Oh, that's good. There was a name you gave me that you're looking for an attorney at.
Yeah.
Who was the name of the person you were trying to get the information about?
I don't even know if we need it, but Chad McGrady, he was Ken Gage's attorney.
What's Gage's first name?
Ken.
Ken?
Ken, yeah. And he was there at the prison when Hansen was there. He's friends with Manfred, or he was. And what Ken Gage got involved when we were trying to find it, and he said that he had a map of the area that he had gotten from Hansen.
And, well, Chad McGrady called me back here a couple days ago, but I wasn't able to connect with him.
Okay.
And he said, call me anytime, Bill. And I just haven't been able to make that because I wanted to get some more information on this from you guys.
Okay. And Now, because of you, we figured out we didn't know why he talked. How we always talked to each other about this. How did he talk and get 85 years? Now I understand. Did his son actually get the money? Do you know?
Yes, got to 60,000.
Okay.
Not the my understand. Well, pardon me. I can't verify that, but my understanding is that 60 was paid. Freddie only wanted to go after 40. If the kid had never been paid, and Freddie wouldn't have given up the body, in my opinion, if the money hadn't changed hands.
Okay.
We see that happen all the time. Like I say, somebody wants some cigarettes in the jail or something like that. And so what will happen is one of their family members will pay a guard a bunch of money, and the guard brings some tobacco in. That, and our guards, some of the guards are capable of that. Okay.
Right.
And they've caught guards doing that.
Okay.
But I think probably the money did change hands. I really do believe that.
Oh, I do too. But what I'm trying to get to here is he could have done that deal himself. So he was thinking about his son, which was
very much
thing to do. Because if he would have, he probably could have gotten, like you said, I mean, he had a pretty good case. You're an attorney. You told him he had a good case. He said to me he wished he would have listened to you back then.
I thought he had a damn good case, and we've seen that happen all the time where somebody will come in and say, okay, fine, I'll tell you where I put this stuff, or I'll and you negotiate like that. It's quite common like I said, flea bargain, but you know, my client's got something, and if you guys want it, what are we gonna get out of this thing?
Well, what do you think, Bill? We're about ready to wrap this the season up, and we're going to wrap it up probably either this Wednesday or the following Wednesday with our video with you and our conversation with you. What do we do next? Because we want to put a team together. We want to put some financing together. We want to come there and see if we can find this cabin. What would you suggest? I mean, can you help us out as far as connections or point us to the right people? What do you think?
I would say I can probably help in two ways. Number one, pointing to the right people, but also making some of these introductions, talking again to some of the people that are in political power here and saying, hey, what is the downside of taking Freddie out of jail for a day, put him in handcuffs, of course, take him down to Burger King, and then drive him up to Anchorage, which is about a two-hour drive from Seward. A little field trip, get them on or maybe just to the Seward police station. I don't think they have Burger King there, but they got McDonald's. Anyway, and you know, get them on a computer and see if he can identify some coastline. Then the other thing is, once Freddie identifies that coastline, I don't think you're going to find the state of Alaska spending money to do the search. You're going to have to raise some capital, whether you have a donation or a GoFundMe or whatever. You're going to have to raise some capital to hire some people to pay gas or whatever, maybe even do a quest or something, a reality TV show, you know, where they could head out on trying to find this. And if Freddie could drag it into a particular area, if we could talk to this Ken Gage, I guess, see if he comes up with some information. If we could talk to Hansen's wife, maybe his kids. I don't know how old his kids were when they went out there, but they might have been teenagers.
And yeah, they were little.
Oh, they were okay. Well, that was
five, yeah.
But try to narrow it down. And then, you know.
Well, we're pretty sure. I mean, that she's buried there. I mean, that's basically what Hansen told Manfred. So, and actually, Shane Emmerich, who would be her nephew, is in prison with Manfred. And we've interviewed him. Last week, we played part of the interview with him. And it really affected his family. It really affected his father, who was her brother. He's got alcohol problems. And it's what, you know, being in the serial killer business, per se, it's what these guys do to generations of families.
I mean, yeah.
It's not just killing the victim. You're killing the whole family. And it would be great. I mean, if we could find this girl, I think it would really do this guy some good, probably do her brother some good. And it would do Manfred some good. He wants to do something good for a change. He's always about that.
How old is Freddie now?
Freddie, I think, is going to be 70, or maybe just turned 70.
Yeah, I just turned 72 here a month ago, April 1st. I don't think that that means this whole thing was April Fool's joke, but I hit 72, and Freddie's at that point in life where what the hell good for society is letting this guy die in prison going to do? He's no longer a threat. He wasn't a threat back then.
Right. That's what you said. Yeah. No, we didn't know him back then, but, you know, that's...
It was, in my opinion, it was a political prosecution. Freddie, unfortunately, did not exercise good judgment, because I'm pretty sure I could have probably done some pretty good for him, or and any other private attorney could have. But unfortunately, back then, you know, hey, we got you a hell of a deal. 85 years, second degree murder. Oh, wow. Boy, what a deal.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah.
And you know, that's disappointing, because
he's taking it
like Freddie. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying he's taking it like a man. I mean, there's not much he can say. I know just by talking to him how he feels about it. He really fucked up, and he should have listened to you. He says that. But then again, he says, you know what? I did a lot of bad things. You know how he talks about it. He said, I got away with a lot of things. If I totaled it up, it'd probably be more than 85 years. So, and I did get straight in here. I did change my life. So he looks at the positives, which is good. And he wouldn't have changed probably if he was still out there. So I guess in that respect, it's good.
Well, you never know. Like you told me at the very beginning, you know, I've been institutionalized all my life. This is my home. As far as myself, I don't have a problem, you know, doing a little bit of inquiry, see if like I said, when I spoke with the governor, there was a certain amount of interest there. Okay. We're right now in the middle of our legislative session. Legislature adjourns in about 2 weeks, and he's consumed by that. He doesn't have time to be thinking about this.
Right.
But
right.
Conceivably, once things quiet down, there could be some additional interest there. If nothing else, talk about it over in hunting camp, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, all I can say is thank you.
Thank you very much.
We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day.
Well, you know, I feel like I've had a catharsis now, because you have to maintain these confidences, you know, forever. And this is one where I've respected Freddie's confidences, but he has authorized me to talk about it. And I'm actually enjoying that the people can get what that Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story.
The rest of the story. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. and I'm sure, you know, everyone's going to just love this, because you know Freddie like we don't know Freddie. And what you've just been able to tell us is pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah. And, great story.
Especially with Tony. I mean, Tony's been dealing, you've been friends with him since 2006.
16 years. Right.
Writing? Yeah, since 2006. And because Tony, you know, he was head injured. You knew that story, right?
Right.
Brain injured survivor. And he took it up as a hobby. And he wrote to Hansen. And Hansen gave the letter to Manfred. And Manfred wrote Tony. Seemed like a good guy. Mm-hmm. And Tony wrote him back, and they just started up a friendship. This was before all this other shit started. This stuff didn't start until Manfred actually kind of got caught by Hansen talking to cold case people. The guards beefed him out. So what did they do? They didn't put Hansen in the hole. They put Manfred in the hole for his own safety. And that's when he wrote to Tony. He said, hey, can you help me out? He said, I'm in the hole. They're going to transfer me probably to Arizona. And here's some of the stuff I know. Could you make some phone calls? And that's how he got this thing going. So it's been going for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, almost 17 years now. So.
Well, yeah, that's a hell of a deal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I got to hand it to you, Tony. Your dad's told me a lot about you. And you've opened up doors that nobody else has been able to even find the lock on.
Oh, yeah, I like that. That's a good,
that is
good
great.
Statement.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay, well, maybe I'll get my 15 minutes of fame yet. You never know.
You will.
You will, because, you know, we got all kinds of things cooking. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But I think we're getting real close, Bill. And you've been a big help. And will you let me know if this guy calls you, Chad? Is that his name, Chad?
I'll tell you, Chad McBrady, I'll tell you what, I will call Chad as soon as we hang up. I'll try again, because he did text me back and he said, would you please, you know, give me a call. My problem, I've been doing a whole bunch of trials, and I just, you know, it's one of those things that, and plus I've also lost the name of this Ken Gage. I think you had texted it to me, but now that I have it written down, I'll call him right now.
All right.
Okay.
Well, Bill, we can't thank you enough. Buddy.
Yeah, thank you so
appreciate
much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We will talk to you soon.
Yes, sir.
All right. You take care of yourself.
This is Joey Siaglia, and thank you for listening to Murder Phone, hosted by my brother Tony Siaglia, the subject of the best-selling book, The Serial Killer Whisperer, and his co-host, who also happens to be our father, Al Siaglia. For more information on the show, please visit murderphone.com, where you can ask questions, link to our social media accounts, and much, much more. If you'd like to help support the Murder Phone podcast, please go to our Buy Me a Coffee page and sign up for a membership package. You can access all kinds of cool, exclusive content that only official Murder Phoniacs can get. Please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and an iTunes review would be much appreciated.
Well, leave one if you liked it, but if you didn't, fuck it.
Murder Phone was written and produced by Tony Siaglia and Al Siaglia, and recorded at the Level 9 Studios in Las Vegas, Nevada. A special thanks to our friend Justin Borrego for his editing magic. Join us next week for another exciting episode of Murder Phone.
Yeah, before we go, I want to give a huge shout out to all those living this life after brain injury, our new normal, as so many call it. You are awesome. Keep going. I know I will. And to my listeners that know someone living with a brain injury or other mental health issues, please be kind, be patient, and most of all, be understanding. Remember, they are doing the best they can.